Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Harry Litman, a former United States Attorney and a Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department, who is currently a Professor of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Litman.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be back.
Well, thank you, Harry. And what do you make of the Democratic rebuttal? Obviously, there's a lot to talk about with Paul Manafort and Rick Gates and where that stands. But in general, it seems to me that, you know, the Democratic rebuttal, first of all, there was a double standard. The Nunes memos was put out over the objections of the DOJ and the FBI without any care or concern about sources and methods and declassified information being revealed. But a different standard was applied to the Democrats. It was heavily redacted and held up for some time and released, of course, on a Saturday, which is not exactly a busy news day. So already it seems to me that we're not talking about a level playing field here.
You know, this is a really good point that most people are missing sight of, it seems to me. There's the whole scrum over who's right, who's wrong. I do think it's by and large an effective rebuttal of everything in the Nunes memo. But what underlies this is something that Nunes and the president and the majority on the Intelligence Committee just seem to either have overlooked, forgotten about, or are being totally cavalier towards, which is the real cost of bringing this into the political arena. So you're totally right. Before the Nunes memo was released, the Justice Department and the director of the FBI took this extraordinary step of making going over to the White House and saying, don't do this. This could reveal sources and methods, which, by the way, is the coin of the realm for the intelligence community. The development of a source and method is painstaking, extremely valuable, and not fungible. You can't just go down to Target and get a new one, and you could really put people's, agents' lives at risk. They just ramrodded past that completely, didn't care about it. And at least with the Democrats, I'm sure, the Bureau and the Department weren't thrilled about the Schiff's memos being released, but just as you say, they worked with them over a couple weeks to redact material and mitigate, make the best of a bad situation, and not compromise sources and methods and other information too gravely. That is completely aside from the merits on both sides. Even if Nunes's memo had been completely well taken and there had been some credible case of bias, infecting the entire FBI and unfairness of not saying this detail in the Steele dossier, even if all that had been true, and as best we can tell, it's 100%, false, tendentious, and political. But even if it had been true, this very more serious concern would have been in the background. And basically, it's being forgotten in the back and forth over who's right, who's wrong between Nunes and Schiff.
Well, of course, the sad part about this, Harry Litman, is that, we've become a society in which there's no consensus about what is true and what is real anymore. We're not unlike Putin's Russia, where propaganda is the coin of the realm. I mean, it hasn't taken over totally, but you've got about 35% of the American people believing anything that Trump says, and he's tweeting all kinds of crazy stuff out, blaming Hillary Clinton, and even blaming his own attorney general for not going after Hillary Clinton. So it's an amazing situation where, in order to cover up for Donald Trump, the Republican Party, the enablers, are basically trashing the DOJ and the FBI in order to protect Trump, whose defenses are laughable. And by the way, need I remind our audience that it was Jim Comey, according to Hillary Clinton, who swung the election for Trump. So how can anybody say that the FBI are a bunch of, closeted Democrats working against Trump?
Yeah, I mean, this is anecdotal, but I think others will tell you that, the conventional wisdom is that agents, rank-and-file agents, tend to be pro-Republican, and maybe prosecutors tend to be pro-Democrats, but they all tend to be professional and doing their job. And by the way, since you mentioned rank-and-file agents, I mean, that's another big hole in this whole story. Again, even separate from the merits, the supposed party line here is, oh, we like the rank-and-file agents. Of course, they're doing a good job, and we're not positing some massive conspiracy, you know, root and branch. It's just the political actors in the FBI. But that completely misses the point that it's the very rank and file here who generate these applications very painstakingly. It goes through many levels of review, all in the career staff from a branch office all the way up to headquarters. That seems to be overlooked. And the other small point that seems to be overlooked is the court itself, the four Republican judges who looked at the material and said with apparently great justification, you know, this is a Russian agent. And by the way, we are getting valuable information with each of these four applications, which, by the way, again, started before the Steele dossier was even in the picture. Things were initiated without regard to the Steele dossier. The entire indictment, if you will, from Nunes, it would be that on some subsequent application, the bona fides, not the bona fides, the possible bias of Steele was not completely revealed. But it's nuts, because first, the fact that he had a possible bias was revealed, that it was on behalf of a political party. But people misunderstand the nature and provenance of most of the attestants in these kinds of applications. They're generally speaking people with much stronger biases than a guy like Steele, like they're agents of foreign hostile powers who are very hard to trust, and the judges are very used to sifting through that and trying to figure out what makes sense and what doesn't. Steele is a guy who was a respected member of the British Intelligence Service with a track record of producing good information. And yes, he's now a gun for hire, if you will. But like any other expert, if he's simply a patsy for whoever the client is, his reputation will, you know, his career would evaporate quickly. He's someone who must be, whose whole professional standing derives from giving good information. And of course, here he was initially hired not by the Clinton campaign, but by a conservative think tank, and the Clinton campaign picked it up after the think tank was out of the picture. So, you know, the dog doesn't hunt in 36 different ways, but the biggest thing I think for, as a former law enforcement guy, that I think of is just the cavalier way in which this put into the public realm and the complete indifference to the danger to really important mission of federal law enforcement.
And again, I'm speaking with Harry Litman, who is a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice. He's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. Let's turn to the squeeze on Manafort from Special Counsel Robert Mueller and the extraordinary behavior of Rick Gates, Manafort's partner, who is now basically cooperating with Mueller, although on February the 1st, which is recent, he apparently lied during the proffer where he was making the deal about a meeting that took place, I think in 2013, with the Putin-friendly Republican Congressman Dana Rohrabacher. So why was, do you think, Harry Litman, why was Rick Gates covering up for Dana Rohrabacher? What was it about this meeting that he lied about?
Yeah, that's a really interesting episode that people haven't dissected. And you know, it's standard injunction in these proffer sessions, these so-called queen for a day meetings, that if you lie, the whole deal is off. So the fact that he did lie, that Mueller caught him in a lie, that he admitted to a lie, and that he's still getting what should work out if he cooperates to be a very good deal, might even keep him out of prison, I think shows the value that Mueller accords to his testimony. Notice how picayune the lie seems. The lie was that Manafort did not discuss with me whether the subject of Ukraine came up. I'm sorry that Manafort denied to me that the subject of Ukraine came up at this 2003 meeting with a lobbyist, Admiral Rohrabacher, when in fact Manafort did not deny that to him. Now, initially, you could ask, how the hell does Mueller know, since Manafort's not saying word one, that in fact it was a lie, that he could so it's another signal lesson in be very, very, very careful before lying to Mueller and his team. You don't know what they know, and they may know much more. I scratched my head to try to figure out how he knows it's a lie. But I think you're right. It must be material. This is not that he lied about what color tie Rohrabacher was wearing. It would not be a federal offense. So something in the investigation traces back to this 2013 meeting and ongoing sort of pro-Putin, anti-Ukraine efforts. Somehow that's material to what Mueller is investigating, or it wouldn't have been a federal offense. How exactly that whole episode, the sort of financial misadventures in the Ukraine, and even the political ones, because the latest indictment of Manafort portrays him as this sort of political mastermind who is bringing to the table a VIP group, in his words, of European politicians in support of the puppet government of the Ukraine. How that all figures in to Mueller's charge, you know, is what watchers of the scandal and the probe are avidly waiting for, like the next edition of a Dickens serial novel.
Right, but the latest charges against Manafort and Gates, which obviously Mueller is waiving in the case of Gates, but they involve falsifying documents, loan documents, and it was apparent that Gates and Manafort were panicked trying to raise as much money as they can because they'd borrowed a lot of money from this oligarch gangster, Deripaska, a friend of Putin's. And it looks as though Putin's buddy, Deripaska, kind of got Manafort on the hook to kind of own him. And then when Manafort became Trump's campaign manager, apparently the pressure was taken off and the threats went away because Manafort was quite useful to the Russians. They changed the GOP platform, make it Kremlin-friendly, etc. And then later on, when Manafort was fired, then Deripaska came back and is suing both Manafort's and Gates for a missing $20 million of his money. So that would indicate to me that there's a story there, isn't it, about borrowing money from a gangster?
100% there's a story there, and borrowing money not from a gangster, but from all kinds of banks with falsification, et cetera, a financial desperation from Manafort, and even, as you say, the equivalent, this is no casual possibility, that the campaign manager of a major political party was in fact a Russian agent in the old-fashioned Tom Clancy sense of, you know, doing the bidding of Russia. I don't want to, it seems to me a far-fetched, implausible conclusion when you think of it straight up, but it might be the least far-fetched and implausible of many far-fetched and implausible conclusions. I mean, one thing it does help explain is why is Manafort so steadfastly refusing to cooperate when, you know, he's basically cooked. He has no odds of beating the rap, especially with Gates' now personal testimony. The paper case was already very strong against him. So I don't want to jump to, you know, the equivalent of a conspiracy theory that he, you know, of Manchurian candidate kind of overtones. But I don't want to completely discount them either, because there are certain facts that are very hard to square or to explain, and they begin with the continual solicitousness of the president to Russia and Putin in a way that he's doesn't behave to any leader of the free world, much less of the world or any country, and then Manafort's dogged intransigence. There are other theories there. For instance, sure. Thought that he's going to get a pardon. But the point you make, I can't offhand rebut it.
Right.
It just seems like, holy cow, is that possible?
Right.
And maybe it is.
Well, just in closing, though, when you mentioned that Manafort is cooked and that Mueller has him, would that mean then that Manafort, being the pretty ruthless guy that he is going to fall on his sword for Donald Trump in the hope he'll get a pardon?
So, and interestingly on this point, Ian, I don't know if you saw the acerbic, nasty, jibe he took at Gates for pleading. There's a kind of
right.
a Goodfellas dynamic here of the
right.
former partners in crime kind of coming apart. That's one thing it could mean. We do know that Trump stayed in contact with Manafort after he was fired. And, of course, we do know that if Manafort were to reveal this, that he has some assurance of a pardon, it might cook Trump's goose because it would be obstruction. So that seems one possibility. Another is from the previous nightmare scenario that what he's really afraid of is, the consequences to himself and his family from Putin. I want to say that I just don't know. It's sort of the $32,000 question here, the $64,000 more concern. Trump, I would say.
Mm.
But look, it's not because he thinks he'll beat the rap. No sensible counsel would have advised him that he has any chance of not spending the rest of his life in prison. So he must be thinking about something else.
Well, Harry Litman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Harry Litman, who is a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who is currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the dangerous complexities of a rapidly changing combined war in Iraq and Syria.